ship comes in.
This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. And you are listening to Ecotopia, a weekly program exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, and technological. I'm Susan Chudy.
And I'm Stephen Chudy. This week our topic is California's water future, centering on a conference being held this Thursday and Friday at the Sierra Nevada Big Room. It's sponsored by Aqua Alliance. It will include a number of water specialists as speakers and workshop leaders, asking the difficult question of whether California will prepare to have sufficient water for coming generations.
One of those specialists is John Herrick, who is the general counsel for the South Delta Water District in Stockton. He'll be the keynote speaker at lunch on Thursday, speaking about Delta fundamentals, the origin of the crisis. And we'll be talking with him on the phone in just a few minutes.
Also with us in the studio is Jim Brobeck of Aqua Alliance. And in the second half of the program, we'll be asking him about the plans for the conference. We might hear a little bit of music from Jim. And we'll also invite him to participate in our discussion with John Herrick. Meantime, full conference details and registration information are online at www.aqualliance.net.
Ecotopia is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR members and by Grid Alternatives, a nonprofit organization bringing the benefits of renewable technology to low-income communities in the North State and beyond. Grid Alternatives leads teams of job trainees, community volunteers, and corporate sponsors to install solar power for cost-burdened homeowners across the state. Call the North Valley Regional Office to learn how to get involved at 530-217-6115. Ecotopia is also made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR members and by Aqua Alliance, hosting a unique two-day conference to provide historical, scientific, legal, political, and visionary information regarding California's water. The conference will be held at the Sierra Nevada Big Room on November 29th and 30th. For more information, visit Aqua Alliance.com. That's AQUALLIANCE. It's one A in the middle. Aqualliance.net or call 895-9420.
The opinions voiced on Ecotopia do not necessarily represent the views or opinions of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, or programmers. We'll take a short break and then be back to talk with John Herrick of the South Delta Water Agency. This is Ecotopia on KZFR. Tonight we're discussing California's water crisis. It will be the subject of a two-day conference this Thursday and Friday, sponsored by Aqualliance at the Sierra Nevada Big Room. In the studio with us tonight is Jim Brobeck, who will be talking with us in detail about the conference later in the hour. On the phone with us now is John Herrick. He's counsel and manager of the South Delta Water Agency. He'll be speaking here in Chico on Thursday. Recently in the Lodi Times, John was quoted as saying that the proposed massive diversion of water from the Delta is insane and that, quote, it's time to get pitchforks and torches and march on the government. We're all in favor of pitchforks. We're interested to hear your strong words. Welcome, John Herrick.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure to be given this opportunity.
And before we ask you about the pitchforks and the torches, could you just please tell us a little bit about the South Delta Water Alliance and what you do for that agency?
The South Delta Water Agency was originally part of a single Delta agency, which was created to be a sort of a political voice when the state water project was being contemplated. The powers to be decided that if they were going to build and operate these massive projects and use the Delta as a transfer facility, then the locals needed an ability to bind together and petition government for various things. So they created a Delta agency to seek a contract with the state or federal governments to supply them, to make sure they had water. And then they eventually found out that the interests were so diverse, that they needed three water agencies. And so in 1972, we created the South Delta Water Agency. Our job is to either get a contract to protect water quality and quantity or to act on our own to protect those interests.
So is this a state agency?
It's created by state law, but it has nothing to do with state government, really. It's elected local officials filling out the board.
One of the things that I found really confusing, and we've been trying to follow some of these water issues, our guest Jim Brobeck has been on the show two or three times, and there are just so many agencies that are involved. There are public water agencies, authorities, consortiums in the Central Valley. Can you sort some of that out for us and tell us how these various agencies work together to protect water or set policy or how that all happens?
Well, that's a very broad and difficult question to answer.
I know, it's huge, and I'm so confused.
Basically, there are a few different categories that everybody fits into. First, we have the state and federal governments, and they each operate their own water delivery system, and that includes upstream dams, channels, canals, pumps in the delta. They were constituted to improve make these improvements in order to deliver water to certain drier areas. So they each have contractors, and so a lot of different water agencies are contractors of these projects so that they pay money and water is delivered to them so they can deliver them to either their municipal or their agricultural clients. Besides that, there are water agencies throughout the state, whether it's local for ag, local for municipal, area-wide. There are all sorts of other agencies whose job is to find, secure, process, and deliver water for the various beneficial uses.
Mm-hmm.
Then there are all sorts of regulatory agencies who look over the shoulder of all those agencies and try to make sure that what they do is in compliance with water quality laws, water rights maybe, mm-hmm. so that they operate without harming some other third party.
Mm-hmm.
But like you said, in those categories there are literally hundreds and hundreds of agencies, and in any particular instance or place in the state, you might involve scores of different agencies fighting over the same thing.
You're an attorney, counsel, as well as manager of the South Delta Water Agency. What sort of official or unofficial power does your agency have?
Well, we have very little power. The statute gives us the ability to assess the area, to gather funds, and of course that's limited by Proposition 218 now to your ability to go higher than that requires an election. But basically, our board hires me and a few other people periodically to, unfortunately, argue with the state and federal governments over their maltreatment of the South Delta.
Mm-hmm.
So I spend all of my time participating in monitoring processes, petitioning and arguing and insulting the various agencies who are adversely affecting the South Delta. And there are a lot of them.
Yeah. So we've talked with Jim Brobeck, as I just mentioned, and Barbara Vlamis, who's the executive director of Aqua Alliance, about the Bay Delta Conservation Plan and the peripheral tunnels. How do you assess those peripheral tunnels? What are some problems that you see?
Well, the problems are myriad, and feel free to cut me off as I
know.
In my speech here, but the first problem is it's constituted based on a false premise. And the premise is if we can just redo some plumbing, we can get the water we need and not adversely affect the fisheries.
Yeah.
Well, that's just plain false. Mm-hmm. And the reason it's false, or the reasons, include the fact that when they first anticipated these projects, they actually investigated the amount of water available. So they came up with numbers for historic to date, how much water did the system produce, and that tells you how much water you can export over time.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, it changes every year.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when they did that investigation, they determined that during a repetition of the 28 through 34 drought, which is the Dust Bowl era, Dust Bowl
right.
drought,
mm-hmm.
the system, the Sacramento and San Joaquin Rivers, produced 17.6 million acre-feet a year average. So each
mm-hmm.
year produced that much. During that same six-year period, the local needs, no exports, the local needs were 25.6 acre feet. So the system is 8 million acre feet short in an extreme drought every year. Now, to give you some idea of the scope of that, Shasta Dam is only, 5-6 million acre feet of storage. So if you're trying to provide for 6 years of 8 million acre feet shortage each year, you've got an insurmountable problem.
Right.
Now, let me just add one thing to that. When I give that lecture, I have people sometimes yelling in the background or call me a liar, and I laugh.
Mm-hmm.
That's not true. There's plenty of water. It's just the interference of protecting fish. Well, we know it's not true, and we know it's not true because of recent history. 2007 and 2008 were drought years, and they thought 2009 was going to be a drought year. It turned out it wasn't, but at the beginning they thought it was. At the beginning of 2009, the state and federal projects petitioned the regulator and said, please don't force us, or please don't enforce permit condition to meet fishery flows because we don't have enough water to provide that.
Mm.
And then they also said to their number one contractor, and, you know, take a long explanation, but they're called the exchange contractors. They said, by the way, we don't think we have enough water to deliver to you. So after 2 years of drought, the federal and state projects were bankrupt. They couldn't deliver the water they're committed to deliver, or even a percentage of it. Now, that gives you an idea of the magnitude of the problem we're facing. Now, there was water behind the dams, mm-hmm. but that water is for, you know, a little carryover for the next year, a certain amount of minimum pool in order to have cold water for fish later in the year. There's all sorts of things that go into that. But they did not have enough water, according to them, to meet the minimum fishery flows wow. in the beginning of the third year of drought.
Wow. Yeah.
That's the problem.
Right.
And anybody that says we have enough water is just whistling in the wind. Because if we had plenty of water, there wouldn't be any fights.
Right, right.
But we don't. So anyway, that's one of the reasons. If you're going to build a $14 billion project because you have to have 5 to 7 million feet of water a year and there isn't any water, then you're not addressing the problem. You're trying to steal from someone else.
So what are the legal problems here? I mean, you described the practical problem really well. There isn't, the water just isn't there. But this could be illegal, you think?
Well, that gets into a very detailed analysis because it depends on how and what they do. There are existing statutes which are supposed to protect the priority of water rights. And basically speaking, you know, there's a list, and if you're at the one end, you're the last person shut off when there's no water. If you're at the bottom, you're the first person shut
yeah.
off. Well, the exporters are at the bottom. They're the first person to be shut off. They don't want to be in that position.
No.
And that's why you've heard, we have to have a reliable water supply. Well, that'd be nice, but if there's no water, how can your supply be reliable? Well, if we make their supply reliable, that means that instead of them being shut off, someone else will go without water.
Right.
Because there's not enough water. So they're trying to make an end run around the existing laws. And that's why one of my presentations has a slide called Liars and Cheaters, because in my opinion, it's a concerted effort to get around the current limitations, both physical and legal, on the project. If they have a peripheral tunnel that takes water out before the water goes through the delta, they will. They won't abide by any limitation or agreement. You know, they will take the water when they need it. It's their theory that the delta will get better if less fresh water flows through it. I hope your listeners savor that for just a moment. You know, they're going to improve the freshwater estuary by having less fresh water flow
mm-hmm.
through it.
3.7 million.
Yeah, it's that insane.
Yeah.
That's the insane part, yeah. Or one of the insane parts. It doesn't make any sense.
And John Herrick, could you clarify, who's the they at the end of the pipeline here? This primarily agricultural use?
Well, I don't have my Kevlar vest on right now, but the big part of the they are the contractors, the agricultural contractors south of the Delta. So that's, mm-hmm. that's all the way from the city of Tracy, kind of, you know, down to Bakersfield area.
Right.
Now, there are other contractors, Los Angeles, you know, the coastal cities. But we've accepted the fact that if 20 million Californians need water in a drought, we're not going to be irrigating crops, right?
No.
20 million Californians will get their water.
Right.
So they're doing a lot of good things down there. They're not necessarily our good buddies. But the agricultural interests who want to deliver 5 to 7 million acre feet of water to an area that doesn't have water are the ones that are driving this ship.
So what kind of legal action can you take? You're an attorney. You're making these arguments. Are there lawsuits that you have underway, or can you take legal action to stop this from operating, to stop the tunnels? You know, what can you do?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
We're going to try a whole slew of things as appropriate. there are certain things that we feel are being done contrary to the law. And so whether or not at any particular point we file actions to enforce the law, that's one thing. But all big projects, as you may know, go through an environmental review.
Right.
And typically, that's the mechanism by which legal challenges arise, which is once they do their environmental review, they adopt it, they certify it, then the rest of the world, the public, can then sue and say, you didn't adequately investigate this, your conclusions are wrong, you didn't protect the environment or third parties, all those things. However, I want to make clear that you can't sue someone and say, you came up with a stupid project.
Mm-hmm.
You know, government does stupid things every day.
Right.
And the law only allows you to challenge whether or not the effects of that project have been adequately investigated and addressed as necessary. It's a very tough hurdle to cross for us.
So these are environmental impact statements. They have to say what's going to happen to the Delta. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And we've seen, with Monsanto as a kind of perfect example in another sphere, where environmental impact statements are, they just redefine things so that you don't have to really attend to the environmental impact statement because you're doing something other. I mean, there's a lot of gerrymandering in kind of this, the legal environmental impact statement activity.
That's right. That's correct. The CEQA, or the environmental challenges, or NEPA, the federal one, those are challenges as to the process they went through.
Okay.
It doesn't necessarily result in anybody changing their mind. It results in, if you win, them being forced to go back and do some more reexamination and perhaps force them to do better mitigation to protect you.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's any mitigation in this instance. Our hope, my personal hope, is the finances will make this idiocy collapse. When you've got a $14 billion project with 30-year bonds, you've got $1 billion a year in debt service. Now, when you start dividing that $1 billion a year amongst the contractors who are going to pay for this, you have water agencies whose budgets are, you know, $70 million a year now being asked to add an additional $150 million a year payment.
Wow.
Now, once their farmers and their board members are fully understand that, then there's going to be people with me with pitchforks and,
right,
and
right.
torches because
right.
they're going to say, what have our leaders led us to? So
right.
hopefully that will make it all collapse.
You are confident then that the whole thing can collapse. You can stop the project, not just delay it. I'm thinking in part that aren't mitigation processes often kind of piecemeal? You take care of a salmon here, an endangered species there. But the project still goes on unabated.
Yes, I would not. I would not label me as optimistic. the government and the contractors have shown a very keen ability to destroy the fisheries, and I believe that will continue. If anybody wants to have rivers with fish in them in 50 years, they need to be active in this right now, because the proposed plans will probably result in the extinction of many of the important fish species.
Right.
And the reason I say that is their draft proposal, which they're trying to, put lipstick on now and figure out how to do it. Their draft proposal was described by their own analysis as one that would likely lead to the extinction of many of the species they're supposed to be recovering.
Wow.
That's their own document.
I think it's often, I don't know who your partners are in this, but I think it's really a complex project and it's hard to get people to become activists behind that. Have you found that getting people behind this is a little difficult because of the complexity or because of conflicting sympathies or... whatever.
No, that's absolutely correct. I mean, we're the little guys.
Right.
I don't say that to get sympathy, but, South Delta Water Agency has 147,000
right.
acres
right.
in it, and nobody cares about us. All of the contractor agencies, that includes most of the rest of the state's population.
Right.
And so the people normally hear things like, yeah, we're doing this because we have to, and, you know, fish regulations are evil. You know, so people go, oh, okay, I'm fine. So just communicating our message is difficult, much
right.
less convincing people.
I agree with that, yeah.
We're giving it a shot, and there's an organization called Restore the Delta, which is a nonprofit, which is trying to spread the word as best it can. Of course, that's limitations of money and time and effort and everything.
Sure.
But it's a very difficult job because, as you can hear just listening to me, you know, people like me can rant and rant and rant, but that doesn't mean it soaks into the general public or inspires them to take action. Because as long as your tap turns on, there's really,
right.
you know, there's really no reason for you to know that there's a problem.
Right. So how can people express their concern, or where should they go to express their concerns about this?
You know, I would recommend the Restore the Delta website. It's a good starting
okay.
position. But everybody should make it known to their agency, whoever provides them with water, if someone does, to say, you know, it's our view that the current water rights laws and priorities should be enforced, and people who are responsible for destroying the Delta fisheries should be made to mitigate them before tax dollars go to improving them. That, by the way, is the law, but that's another of those weird, insane parts of the Bay Delta Conservation Plan. They're going to build tunnels, and then the California taxpayer is going to pay for
right.
what they label as the mitigation. That's mitigation for their impacts for the last 40 years.
Right.
But they're going to make us pay for it.
Right.
But that's the kind of issue they should bring up to their local officials, their water agencies. They should make their views be known.
A letter to the editor of the Lodi Times noted in response to an article about your presentation that there are convoluted approaches to Delta solutions, and the person asked, will there ever be an amicable solution acceptable to all? John Herrick, what's your full or partial answer to that one?
I'm smiling as you ask that because I get that question a lot. What everybody wants me to do, and the others here in the Delta, is to negotiate the caliber of the bullet to be shot at.
Uh-huh.
And so my answer is, there are many things that can be done. Follow the rules, you know, apply the law, obey the hydrologic limitations, and then the system will adjust. It'll reach equilibrium. If the solution someone seeks is the ability to export 5 to 7 million acre feet out of the Delta, there is no solution.
No solution. Mm.
And that sounds, that sounds petty or stupid on my part, but the facts are the facts. There isn't some untapped supply that you can route through the Delta to provide that need. It isn't there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in wet times, we can give them lots of water. We don't mind. But in dry times, they take the water, and the natural result of that is the fisheries have crashed. Delta water quality standards are violated all the time. And just for good measures, they decide to attack local Delta water rights, too. So it's an ongoing battle. The solution is somebody should obey the law. There's no negotiated settlement.
Thank you, John. We've been talking with John Herrick. He's the counsel and manager of South Delta Water Agency. He'll be here on Thursday, lunchtime address at the Aqualliance Conference. Thursday lunch. His topic is Delta Fundamentals, the Origin of the Crisis. We really want to thank you for being with us tonight, John, and we'll look forward to hearing your presentation on Thursday.
Thank you. My pleasure. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you.
Stole the water, gonna swim forevermore, but he'll never reach the land of the golden shore. The faint white light will hurt his heart till his only memory lost in the dark. Dig your own in the ground all the way down to hell till there's no more water. When you're down on down on your knees. Nothing left yourself. All in the hole. Till we pay the price, we don't know the worth of air in the water and the earth. Dig your hole in the ground on the way down to hell, till there's no more water in the well, well, well. When you're down on your knees, nothing left to sell. Try. Stole the water, gonna swim forevermore, but he'll never reach the land of that golden shore.
That's the amazing singer songwriter Jim Brobeck, who is also multi-talented as a water analyst, and he is our guest on Ecotopia on KZFR. We are talking about California water issues, and we just got a taste of that cool water from the well that we're trying to hold on to. The conference is Thursday and Friday at the Sierra Nevada Brewery. Aqua Alliance will have a workshop called, I think the conference is called Water for Seven Generations. Will California prepare for it? And so now Jim will talk about what's going on at the conference. He is a policy analyst for Aqua Alliance, and he'll give us more details about the conference. Thank you so much for coming, Jim, and thank you for that wonderful song and your always inspirational or depressing music. So the conference, what's the purpose of the conference? Why is Aqua Alliance holding a conference on water?
We want to present our side, the people's side of the story. That interview just did with John Herrick was excellent. And as you said, he's going to be one of the primary speakers. And he really, really laid out some important things there. You know, it is the 99% of the people that rely on a water supply here in California. It's about 1% of the people that want to misuse this water supply to grow inappropriate crops or to get engaged in the water market. He said there is no water to be adding these extra millions of acre feet to run through the tunnels that Governor Brown is supporting. Well, the state of California and the feds think there might be water right underneath our feet. They want to fold the groundwater that underlies Butte County and Glenn County and Tehama County and Colusa County into their portfolio of water supplies. They actually think it would be to their advantage to suck it out and create a space underground to store water in case we ever do get like a 1997 winter where we did actually have some surplus water. Most years, there's not that much surplus water. And Aqua Alliance's primary concern is that they are going to try to fold the aquifer, the Tuscan aquifer, into their portfolio and destabilize the aquifer and all the surface, the quality of life on the surface that we all rely upon as far as the oak groves and the stream flow and the salmon, as well as the shallow wells that many private people rely upon. And the people up in the foothills are not immune from this. There are some indications that the people with the deep wells in Forest Ranch and Cohasset are also on the Tuscan Aquifer and certainly on the way up gradient portion of this semi-confined aquifer. So Aqua Alliance, under the leadership of Barbara Vlamas, has a point of view, a very region-specific point of view, but it is tied in with the whole state. John Herrick was talking about how 23 million Californians depend in part on the water of Northern California. And in fact, those people south of the Tehachapis used to have what's called the urban preference. So when the water supplies did get slim, when we had a dry year, the industrial farmers in the San Joaquin Valley just would not plant their plant their cotton that year.
I didn't know that.
They grew annual crops, and if there wasn't a surplus, they just give the land break and make sure there's enough water for the people in Southern California who are making great strides to use the water more efficiently in an appropriate way. Okay. But for some reason, the bosses of the Metropolitan Water District and the bosses of the San Luis Delta Mendota Water Agency and Westlands Water District got together, and the Metropolitan Water District gave up their urban preference during something called the Monterey Agreements. This is something that perhaps Michael Jackson, an attorney, a renowned water attorney who is also a board member of the California Water Impact Network, will be speaking about. I believe he'll be talking on Thursday. I may forget some of the people. We've got quite a list of people here. But Mike Jackson is a very articulate water attorney, as John Herrick is, and he'll be discussing strategies to try to get the ratepayers in the Metropolitan Water District on our side to pressure their water supplier to demand they get the urban preference, since they're only getting 20% of the water. There's enough water even on dry years to supply them with their needs so that their kitchen and their bathtubs have water.
Right.
But there is
Michael will be in on Friday, by the way.
Friday, okay. Yep. So he'll be in the groundwater day. Mm-hmm. Todd Green is another person who will be in there. He's a professor over at the university, and he has been doing some studies on the geology using some cuttings from some production wells that were drilled by the Glen Clusa Irrigation District. They drilled four wells a few years ago, and they bypassed strict environmental review because they claimed it was just for investigative purposes, but they've been using these wells every year to pump up to 5,000 gallons a minute into their canals. That frees up their surface water allocation for other uses, and that may be for sales south of the Delta.
Right.
And so Todd Green is going to be giving a presentation. What's interesting about that is that when the Glen Clusa Irrigation District drilled those wells, saying, "Well, this is for scientific analysis of the," but they didn't save enough money in their budget to analyze the cuttings that came out of the well. They saved those cuttings. And Barbara Vlamis won a lawsuit against the state of California for the Drought Water Bank a few years ago. And part of the settlement was $50,000 would go to scientific investigation. Keep in mind, a lot of people think that when environmental groups engage in lawsuits, they do that to fund their own coffers. It doesn't work that way. It costs money to bring a lawsuit. The most an environmental group gets out of it is they get their court costs. And if they get extra money, that money has to be sent somewhere else to help mitigate some of the damage or some of the threats that the original project that gets shot down. And so a significant amount of money has gone to the California State University staff to analyze these well cutting data. So Todd will be there to talk about his findings on the stratigraphy, on what the layers are, how the aquifer is formed.
So you have people really from all over the state coming to this conference.
We've got people from the Owens Valley. There's a man named Dan Pritchett. He's an Owens Valley activist. The Owens Valley is an area that used to support a very viable farming community, and just a beautiful valley, verdant valley, with copious amounts of water. Well, the water pirates in Southern California bought up land and sucked the Owens Valley dry till the lake went dry. Now it's an air pollution problem for people as far south, ironically, as Los Angeles.
Right.
Because this alkaline dust blows in the wind and enters the atmosphere and creates health hazards. Well, Dan Pritchard will be there on Friday to talk about the impacts to unreasonable groundwater use and water exportation on an area. So he'll give us an idea what it might be like if they're allowed to fold the Tuscan Aquifer into the state water supply, because it could dewater our streams.
It's an object lesson, isn't it? Really, what has happened in the Owens Valley should be like a red flag to anybody who sees the Tuscan Aquifer becoming a part of this system.
And another possible impact is land subsidence. There's areas of the San Joaquin Valley that have collapsed, and so that the surface of the ground is 20 to 40 feet lower than it was, which can create tremendous infrastructure problems.
And you hear that the water table has fallen by 300 feet in the
when the water table
the same
falls
areas.
By that much, and then the whole thing can collapse to some extent. And one of the reasons they created the Central Valley Project and the State Water Project is to kind of reduce the demand on the groundwater in the San Joaquin Valley. They
right.
tried to reverse the subsidence trend. Well, it never did reduce the demand. They kept demanding more and more water. They kept pumping the water out of the ground as well as importing Sacramento Valley water and increasing their demands. So a woman named Michelle Sneed is going to talk about the return of rapid subsidence in the San Joaquin Valley. This is another thing that threatens the Sacramento Valley, is land subsidence. And you've got local water district and water managers up here that say, well, we're monitoring to make sure we don't have subsidence. But Dr. Kim Misch, an engineer, I believe he's in the University of Arizona, who's one of Aqua Alliance's consultants, has told us that things like land subsidence take years, maybe decades, to occur
right.
after the aquifer has been dewatered. So you can't do real-time monitoring of land subsidence. Mm-hmm. You can create the conditions for land subsidence and not get land subsidence for decades.
For a long time, yeah.
But if those conditions persist, you can't reverse them rapidly. You can't just put water back in and hope the clay layers suck the water back up. It does not work mm-hmm. that way. So real-time monitoring for land subsidence, an inadequate monitoring protocol. So these are the kind of things that we want to bring forth and get in the public's eye. And hopefully some local leaders, some local representatives will show up. We tried to get a representative from the Department of Water Resources. We invited them to come. They didn't respond to our invitation. We did get acquiescence from Thad Bettner, who is the general manager of the Glen Clouse Irrigation District, and his contracted engineer, Grant David, who have put together a project that does consider folding the groundwater into their supply. Now, the Glen Clouse Irrigation District is in the process of drilling four more wells. They've already got four high volume production wells that can pump up to 5,000 gallons a minute out of the aquifer.
Oh my gosh.
Into their canals. They want to put
That's
in four
so
more.
Much water.
And those are all the state funded ones that we know about. I would like to find out from Thad if they are using any private funding to put others in, because the water districts on this side of the river, the Butte Basin water districts, also have wells. They participated in the 1990s drought water bank that resulted in uncounted wells in Durham and Dayton and Cherokee to go dry, and Durham Municipal Well to be have to be abandoned because it mobilized pollutants.
So,
and you and Barbara will be on the panel with Thad, so presumably there'll be a chance for some back and forth with him.
Well, Thad and Grant will present first, and then I've got a presentation. I'll be talking about some San Joaquin Valley history,
mm-hmm.
and then about how that is being threatened to be played out up here, and then at the end, Grant and Thad and I will be available to field questions from the audience.
Mm-hmm.
I had a question about the drought bank mm-hmm. Wells. Could you explain that one more time, because it just went by me? So there's a drought bank for...
It's called a drought water bank.
It was
a state-designed project in which water that would normally be used for irrigation that was being pulled from rivers, in this case the Feather River for the Butte Basin water users, they've got the rights to a certain amount of diverted water out of the Feather River to grow mostly rice. And if they leave that water in the river and it flows down to the delta, it can be pumped out of the delta and sold to buyers down south. And they can they then replace that water with groundwater. They turn their pumps on, and they pull the water out of the ground and put it in their irrigation canal and irrigate rice that way,
right.
which greatly increases the demand on the aquifer. Our aquifer is already teetering on the edge of imbalance, just with the existing use of the municipalities in our area and the orchards in the area. If you start growing rice on the groundwater as well, that's it, baby. The groundwater levels will be destabilized. They will be imbalanced. and they will be in decline. They will be emptied.
Right. So it's a basic solution, or one I know there isn't a solution. I've heard that how difficult that is, but is a major solution for people to stop growing things that the water system can't support and to replace that with other growing or to eliminate a lot of the things that are farmed in California. I mean, it seems a lot of it is, you know, ag is water heavy. It needs a lot of water. So is that a partial solution?
In my opinion, the orchardists in the Sacramento Valley are doing a great job in growing the same amount of trees with less water as they convert from flood irrigation to drip systems and micro sprinklers. So they can grow approximately twice the acreage on the same amount of water.
Okay.
So there's room for them to grow a little bit and still maintain a balanced aquifer. So I think it's very reasonable to grow these high-value orchard crops in Northern California, especially on this side of the valley, with the groundwater, with carefully managed groundwater, and using the most efficient systems. I don't think it's reasonable to double the demand by starting to grow rice, which is a very water-heavy crop. And, of course, they've got tailwater, too. They have to drain those. And if they're growing it on groundwater and the tailwater then is slipping into the river, well, we're, in effect, putting groundwater into the Sacramento River for sale down south. But as far as state of California water policy, absolutely, the west side of the Sacramento of the San Joaquin Valley should not be irrigated. The soils down there are heavily laden with toxic minerals, toxic metals, that are creating huge pollution problems not only in the groundwater but in the tailwater. They had to shut down the Kesterson Wildlife Refuge, which was designed to hold the tailwater, the drainage water from the Westlands Water District. They had to shut down the Kesterson Wildlife Refuge because it wasn't a refuge. It was a death chamber for the birds that were down there trying to regenerate. So now that water ends up in the whatever's left of the San Joaquin River, polluted water flowing all the way to the Delta, and then they've got to dilute it with clean Sacramento River water in order to make it usable for the farmers in the Delta area. So reducing demand is the key strategy. Conservation of the use that's going to carry on, and then reducing demand primarily in these huge industrial farms that are on the west side of the San Joaquin Valley. Mm-hmm. This will go a long way to preserving California's ability to supply water for its business, for its environment, for its people. If these billionaire so-called farmers that have the 10,000, 20,000, 100,000 acre farms in the San Joaquin Valley only grow crops during years where there's tremendous amount of rain. And that's not the way it's playing out, because these guys are so rich they can manipulate the political system. They put a lot of money into California Democrat politics. So, you know, they're major suppliers of campaign funds for guys like Jerry Brown and before him, Gray Davis, both Democrats. So it's really an important consideration. Democrats, in this case, we need to get the Republicans in Northern California on our side and get them up to speed. Unfortunately, Doug LaMalfa is going to take Wally Herger's spot. Doug LaMalfa is in position to sell surface water. He's a rice farmer who grows subsidized crop on subsidized water, and he wants to be able to sell his water when the market for water is high and replace it with groundwater. And he's our representative in Washington now. So that's worse than Herger. So it puts us at risk. But still, we got to keep in mind, it's 99% of us up here are in not a position to take part in this water market. We've got everything to lose and nothing to gain. That's one of our goals at Aqua Alliance, is to educate the public to understand this is one of these 99% issues,
right?
And a very key one, because the water is life in the Sacramento Valley.
Yes. Jim, who should come to the conference?
Water professionals should come. I wish some DWR people would come. Mm-hmm. I'm hoping some local city council people come, and supervisors. Mm-hmm. They should all be coming.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely. These are people that are making the decisions. They should get up to speed If they want to be responsible representatives of the interests of the people, they should come. People who have young people who are looking for a future in advocacy, and this is advocacy that transcends environmental advocacy. And of course, the environment is a key factor, but it's the economy as well. So this is an advocacy issue, a human rights advocacy, economic rights, political rights that should transcend political parties. And I think it's going to be a struggle for decades to come. I think there's a real career available there.
How do you see advocacy coming directly from the conference this Thursday and Friday? You're not preparing a position paper, but are educating the professionals, advocates, and so forth. Where do you see it going?
I see it projecting a vision. I know my presentation is going to be comparing two visions. One of them is the aquifers are emptied. This is the vision of the Department of Water Resources, a California agency. Literally, this is from one of their PowerPoint presentations. The aquifers in the Sacramento Valley are emptied to create an underground reservoir. Well, that is going to drain the creeks and kill the oaks and kill all the people that rely on shallow wells. I want to compare that with the vision of Aqua Alliance, is the aquifers are balanced. So we want to project a vision for the future that can provide a high quality of life for the people that want to live, not just in Northern California, but the entire state. And Bill Jennings will be the closing speaker, and he'll be talking as far as statewide vision. So that's what I want to really project out there, that there is a vision for the future, that people who study this stuff every day, that we do have a vision for the future that can carry on for seven generations and beyond if we learn how to conserve water, how to use it wisely, and how to stop using water in inappropriate ways, like watering toxic land with water that's coming from hundreds of miles away. That's ridiculous.
Our guest has been Jim Brobeck. He is he's a water analyst for Aqua Alliance, as well as being a singer-songwriter, a kind of local entertainer. The conference is this Thursday and Friday, and you can go to
aquaalliance.net
and register for the conference. I think people can still register for the conference.
They sure can.
Okay, great. And we're eager to learn more at this conference and to capture the vision and carry that vision on. We thank you so much, Jim, as usual, for being with us. Always really important information with a lot of passion and knowledge behind it. And we really appreciate what you do. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan.
When it rains 5 days and the skies turn dark at night, when it rains 5 days and the skies turn dark at night, then trouble taking place in the lowlands at night. Thunders and lightning and the wind began to blow.
You're listening to Ecotopia on KZFR. Ecotopia is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR members and by EcoCab, Chico's green alternative taxi service. EcoCab provides safe, reliable transportation 24 hours a day in a new fuel-efficient Toyota Prius. Protect the planet and get where you need to be with EcoCab, the cab that cares. Call them at 591-3186.
Coming up at 7 this evening is the storyteller, and tonight Maria and Soren will be sharing information and maybe some stories and maybe some music about bears. At 7:30, host Senor Felipe serves up L.A., East L.A., Cholo, Soul, R&B, oldies, blues, doo-wop, Latin folk, and gospel, plus social commentary and interviews with interesting members of the community. LA Sounds takes you back home to the roots where it all began. Back on the block. Come on home with Senor Felipe. Love that guy. Thank you for listening to Ecotopia. I'm Susan Chudy. And he's Stephen Chudy.
Yes,
contact
indeed.
Us at Ecotopia, kzfr@gmail.com, or visit our website, KZFR, Ecotopia, KZFR.net. You can also follow us on Facebook and often receive advance notice of upcoming shows.